the United States. We had very severe flooding in the early spring, or the early part of 1983. Then in the summer, we had a very disastrous drought in the corn crop region and lost half the corn crop.
We're going to have to pause right now, Tom, for just a second, take time out for the news at 10 o'clock. When we get back, we will talk about something closer to home, if we may, that happened just last December. The strange booms off the California coast and what that bred. And it was, could very well have been, just another one of the battles of the weather war. I'm Bill Jenkins. It's Open Mind. Join us tonight. Have with us from Huntsville, Alabama, on our phone, our conference line, Mr. Thomas E. Bearden. Thomas distinguished himself over the last many years of being very, very totally involved in developing some of America's defense systems, the ability to conduct maneuvers by computer at any time that you want to, has worked with the Pentagon and weapons analysis of the Soviet system. And tonight we're getting a story of how the Soviets have started using a new science that is upon us, scalar interferometry. And there's a lot of reason to believe that that is being used to wage an undeclared weather war. And unfortunately, it seems that we don't even know we're being attacked. But sometime, something closer to home, I think we can all remember this. Early in December, last year. In fact, Thomas, you were here. We were doing a free energy show at that time. The western coast of the United States was rocked by some of these strange explosions from San Diego all the way up to here, window-rattling rocks. There were no ships conducting maneuvers. There were certainly no high-flying jet planes that were giving us a bunch of sonic booms, and they were stronger than that, and they could not be explained. What was happening, Tom?
Well, apparently they had been adjusting the grid for a little while there, because those things had been going on off and on for about a week down south of San Diego and so forth. And so it was apparent that they were doing some adjustment of the grid and the signals on the grid in the area there, in the general Los Angeles area, very close to it. Since they'd been doing that for about a week, that's usually about as long as it takes them to make an adjustment, or it seems to be. So while there, I was on another radio talk show on KABC briefly, and I did point out that you could expect, probably, a drastic change in the weather very shortly. I think I said within 48 hours.
You did.
And, of course, that occurred. Maybe I was just lucky, but that did occur because they had finished adjusting the grid, and so they just simply cranked the thing up. They started working on the jet stream, and you had very anomalous weather suddenly move in.
What we had were some of the strongest windstorms that we had had in Los Angeles. I think some people were killed here because of those windstorms in a related way. And then that weather system really began to work havoc.
What happened? It moved on south after the anomalous Santa Ana-type winds in the Los Angeles area and surrounding. It moved on south down into Texas, spawned a lot of tornadoes and things like that, and generally did its thing all the way across the country. But it started right there with the adjustment in the grid to divert the jet streams and change the weather right in and around Los Angeles.
Did we have an unusual bend in the jet streams at that time?
Yes, it bent further south than it normally does, and then about a month or so later, they really bent it. After they played around with it a while, they bent it in almost a right-angle bend, and it came down the west coast of the United States, something extremely unusual indeed for a giant river of air. Just try to imagine diverting the Mississippi River, for example, and what you'd have to do to dam that thing up or block it so that it would divert aside like that and keep diverting. Something similar to that was happening with the placement of the high-pressure areas and the low-pressure areas in the upper atmosphere over the United States. They bent the jet stream at a right angle so that it flowed south then and came down the west coast of the U.S., bent it again at a right angle so that it now turned and went eastward across the lower end of Texas, Louisiana, and along and through there, and then roared it up the mountain chain across the east, the Adirondacks. And so, with that anomalous bend, of course, you had very anomalous weather start to move in. You had cold air spill in from Canada, come much deeper down south than it normally does, so you had a lot of cold weather and a lot of anomalous weather connected with that. Now, one of the things that you can do with that kind of a bend, which was very much evidenced in the latter 83, when you had the very unseasonable cold weather breaking all the records everywhere, one of the things you can do with that is, of course, bring in cold across a lot of the United States and very far south indeed, so that southern cities were reporting some of the coldest weather they'd ever had. Many of them had records broken, and so did other cities across the United States. The other thing you can do, if you sustain that for a while and don't let it pop back up, you can begin to entrain moisture from well out in the Pacific and drag a flow of moisture in across the southern part of the United States. Now, they did that sort of thing again early this year. As a matter of fact, the first day of February, they moved a giant ice storm across the United States. And so February of 85, we had a very nice anomalous mixture of extremely cold weather drawn down from Canada, mixing with this giant stream of moisture drawn in from the Pacific right across the Southland, and so we had an ice storm. Here in Huntsville, Alabama, for example, in the surrounding area, about 60,000 homes were knocked out of power, and all the motels and hotels and everything were full while people were trying to make it through several days without power. Actually, I also went several days without power and can sympathize with people that that's a bit difficult to do. But anyway, they gave us that nice ice storm. That was courtesy of the Hammer and Sickle Boys.
And then it went on up into the East Coast, where they had record-breaking sub-zero weather that was extremely troublesome. And at last count, approximately how many deaths were endured this last winter that were weather-related?
I don't have an actual count for the whole winter, but it looks like it's been averaging over 100 people a year that you could say... probably due to the change in weather. In other words, the number of deaths due to weather and weather-related effects has just about doubled. And so if you want to make a conservative estimate, you'd say this this change in weather, this anomalous change, has accounted for up to, say, 500 deaths or so that we would not have had had not the anomalies occurred.
But we're having to look at something, whether it's Mother Nature or man, putting a 90-degree turn in the jet stream and then turning it 90 degrees again. Just the ticket. Just the thing necessary to create some very strange havoc weather. Is that a battle of the weather wars? Bill Jenkins with me from Huntsville, Alabama. On our conference line is Thomas E. Bearden. And we are talking about the likelihood of being engaged in a weather war, an undeclared one. We're looking at some of the science that Tom has been explaining to you. Tom, when they developed these interference zones and we have these cross-scalar beams coming together, either extracting energy or creating energy in an area, are there some signatures that you can see, something that gives you a little more validity other than just theory?
Yes, indeed. Fortunately, the clouds react to the particular kind of pattern that's emerging up there, and so the clouds themselves will give you signatures of what kind of thing is going on, and some of these are very much different from any kind of natural thing that occurs in the clouds. For example, one of the patterns that occurs in the cloud I've been calling a giant radial. What happens is a thin line of cloud forms an almost perfect circle, about two-thirds of a circle, and then outside that ring our radials run straight away for about 15 miles or so, usually, in little straight lines. It looks just like a giant rising sun symbol, sort of, from World War II, hanging up there in the sky, in the clouds themselves. When the power is on, in other words, when the actual power is going on, the pattern is very clear. In other words, the lines are very sharp, they're thin, and the ring is a very nice ring. And that kind of a thing just doesn't occur in nature. Now, the moment they cut the power for that particular little goose that they did, so to speak, the inner ring will fill up with clouds, and so you'll have the whole inside part of it filled up. The outside rays then are now running from the filled-in cloud in the middle, and they get a little fatter, but they're still cloud rays. And so for some time before the upper winds chop that thing up and fatten it out and so forth and lose it, you can see a pattern that's still anomalous enough that you know it wasn't done by Mother Nature. And those kinds of signatures have occurred all over the United States. I've seen several of them myself. I photographed several of them. I flew over one. We were at 35,000 feet. It was about 5,000 feet below us, 400 miles from Memphis. They've been widely reported directly off the west coast there from Los Angeles and San Diego. And they've usually been associated with an area about the time that, say, 3 days to a week later, you get an anomalous weather change. Sometimes a weather change the meteorologist didn't even expect at all. It catches them by surprise. And so they are associated with the weather changes. Another pattern that you get is when they are first establishing the grid itself, not adjusting it. Oftentimes, the clouds themselves will form a grid. Under just the right conditions, you will get suddenly in the clouds above you a regular grid just like a checkerboard. I mean, it's like an artist went up there and drew it in the clouds. Now, clouds ruffle and fluffle a bit in nature, quite a bit, but they do not form absolutely geometric grids that cross each other that way. I've described that as looking exactly like a cross-plowed field. It's like you plowed a field north to south, let's say, and then you turned around and you plowed the same field again east to west in nice even rows. That's exactly what the sky looks like above you when this sort of thing is going on.
Do you have any pictures of that?
I have pictures of one of them after the power had been cut again and the grid was being chopped up, so it's not too good. But the one fellow named Bill Jenkins got a pretty good picture of one.
Yes, he did. And it's interesting to note what you said, Tom. I took those videotapes on July 29th at about 10:30 in the morning. The power point was above the Saugus Newhall area, but it was easily seen from my vantage point in the northern part of the San Fernando Valley. And the grid system, it looked to me like a series of Chiclets chewing gum lined up in a row. And those pictures will be available to our listeners in the next issue of Let's Talk magazine. The article I will be writing for it is The Weather War. And we will go over a lot of the information here. We will have pictures of the giant radials. There will be some of the things that Tom is talking about here explained with graphics for you. So I suggest that you look for the next issue of Let's Talk magazine. I didn't think I'd ever be able to see one of those, Tom, but there it was.
Well, it turns out that most of us don't do that much looking at the sky, and when we do, we sort of look in an almost hypnotized fashion. You know, there's the sky, the same sky we saw yesterday, so to speak. We don't really meticulously go around noticing the sky. It has to be remarkable. Something there has to be usually remarkable before we notice it in the clouds. But these particular signatures have been widely sighted over the U.S., over various places in the U.S., everything from the East Coast to right on out to the West Coast, over the middle of the country and everything. In fact, on one of these programs, we had a gentleman call in who was a chicken farmer. And he reported that he had been seeing these things near his farm where he raised chickens, and every time one of those was in the sky, the chickens were very disturbed. And he was wondering if that was connected with that thing. And, of course, it is. The same kind of scalar emissions you get from prior to earthquakes, you get from the stresses in the rocks when an earthquake is building up. And so you get all kinds of animal disturbances because animals sense those things more than we do. We tend to just get a little bit irritable or something like that, whereas the animal reacts physically and gets panic-stricken. And so, yes, indeed, there are animal disturbances connected with them as well. But they've been seen throughout the U.S. That's one signature, the giant radial.
Well, I thought it was interesting what you said a minute ago, that within 48 hours after the appearance of this giant radial and this crosshatch effect in the sky, you can expect some changes in the weather. And the one that we videotaped was on July 29th. And 2 days later, California started burning with the worst fires that it ever had in history. Killer fires. We don't have the data yet to connect all of that. At this moment, it's simply a curiosity, right?
That's correct. We do know that there's been some evidence of the radios active in the area. We know that there's been some evidence of some of the little micro cracks and earthquakes and so forth around there, too. It's a little bit early yet to say what fits what.
Well, I know that the phone lines are beginning to
light up. I would like to say one other thing, Bill.
Okay.
As far as controlling the weather, there are people here in the United States, for example, a few of them, who do indeed go out and do weather engineering. Now, a very good fellow that does that, repeatedly produces results, lives right there in California. His name is Trevor Constable.
Yes. So it is done.
It is done, and it can be done. And I think anybody that looks at his work is going to have to admit he produces what he says he produces.
But here we're looking more than doing something to get rain. It seems to be being used against us in an unusual way.
That's correct. Even the journal Science has pointed out that the weather in the last decade has been more anomalous than you would expect except once in about 1,200 years.
You ready to take on the callers?
We'll take some.
Okay. Let me give you the numbers in Los Angeles. All the numbers end in talk. Thomas E. Bearden and Bob is on the line. Bob, welcome aboard.
Hi there, Bill. Tom, it's an enjoyment every time you're on.
Well, thank you, Bob. It's a pleasure to be here.
Okay, I have a little difficulty hearing you through the phone.
Oh, okay. Maybe that's a little louder. That's as loud as I can get my phone.
Okay. What I want to do is take you through a whole series of little steps here. It's not very long. Tesla said, for instance, he could split the Earth with his extra low frequency standing waves. Of course, we don't know that that could be so, and I think he found out later he couldn't quite, but it was an attempt. These low-frequency waves, which I believe he experimented quite a bit with in Colorado, we had a very high power requirement. The other thing we learned from Tesla was how to fix nitrogen from the air to make nitric acid and to make fertilizer. This is through the having a very high energy spark gap. In the 30s, we threw up in this country from the burning of coal enormous amounts of soft coal smoke all over the country. We did not have acid rain at that time. And we were having only our gasoline fumes. When we look at this phenomenon of acid rain, which is spread widespread in not only in the United States and Canada, but also in Europe and the northern energy countries, we don't hear, or I haven't heard, of acid rain in Russia. So I have a one, but I also know that we are throwing enormous amounts of radio energy up in the air, and I wondered what all of this energy thing may have to do. That is, are we creating some of our own patterns, just like you said, through random choice, or are we the Russians creating some of our acid rain? Are they adding to it? And where do they get the power to sustain these phenomena that you mentioned? Although I do recall an extremely anomalous southernward motion of the jet stream in World War II. That's a pretty involved set of questions, but I think you can follow me.
Okay, let me take a crack at it. It's a good set of questions, by the way. First of all, on acid rain, I have no expertise at all. And I have to admit that straightforward. I do know it's a major concern. For example, the Black Forest in Germany, the very beautiful world-renowned Black Forest, is slowly dying. It's strangling from acid rain. And many other places on the...
I've seen the pictures in National Geographic.
Yes, and you can see what a tragedy that is. And other places in our beautiful forest are suffering in the same way. But I really do not know at all what is causing the acid rain. And even the experts seem to disagree. They basically are trying to blame it on the emissions from the factories and so forth. But as far as I personally know, I don't believe they've really tied down the fundamental mechanism that's producing it. And I don't know what it is myself. As for the Tesla splitting the Earth, we found out that mass for scalar waves, when you establish a scalar resonance, mass can act just like charging a capacitor. In other words, it's an accumulator. if you continue charging unrestrained, the Earth or the mass will continue to absorb more and more and more of this energy stored in this peculiar form. And what Tesla was talking about, although he didn't make it quite that clear, if he were to produce a standing scalar resonance in the Earth and continue to pour energy in it, eventually the energy would build up so high that he could disrupt the Earth. And in fact, that could be done. He said he didn't know how long it would take, maybe 2 years or so. That technically is feasible by using scalar waves. Now, May Day of this year for the Soviet Union was a very special occasion. It was the 40th anniversary, you know, after the end of World War II. And so the 40th year of May Day was very special, and the celebrations lasted for several days this year. Just prior to May Day, they activated, according to measurements of Frank Golden, who has been measuring the scalar stuff they're putting in the Earth, they activated what appears to have been the entire scalar weapon systems in the Soviet Union. Now, one of the things, the Earth already has natural scalar resonances in it. And Frank can put those on the screen, and I've seen them. I've looked at the natural scalar resonances of the whole Earth. But a natural resonance wanders back and forth about some center frequency because the Earth is not a regular structure. However, ever since he's been measuring this, there have been two artificial resonances established in the Earth. They are rock solid, they do not vary, they do not change. And they are Soviet Union resonances established in the entire Earth on the Tesla principle.
Are you saying they are continuously there?
Yes, they have been since he's been measuring, since, say, 83. Now, they were 12 kilohertz apart, and one of the things that they could do with this kind of a tap in the Earth, they could use that difference to tap off ordinary energy. They could convert it into ordinary energy, and they could get enormous amounts of energy from such a tap. That would give them the energy to power enormous transmitters, indeed, to use for strategic weapons of this fashion. Now, what he noticed before May Day was a sudden activation of an enormous amount of those taps. For example, he counted some 27 of those sets of two-frequency taps into the Earth that suddenly came on. And an enormous number of ordinary scalar wave transmissions, which would have been the command and control systems. So apparently, in and around the May Day celebrations this year, the Soviets activated the entire strategic scalar weapon system and rehearsed it, went through exercises with it, cut some things on and off and so forth. But for a while there, it was really, really quite alarming because of the large number of scalar transmitters that were on and the large number of weapon taps. For example, if you estimate that one of those taps could provide power for 4 to 6 weapons, then you see we're talking about something that can approach 100 weapons or so that would have been brought up online and exercised. Just, it would be something similar if we were to bring up all our missile men, for example, our missile man missiles, and go through exercises with them in some giant exercise. The Soviets actually had such a giant exercise, apparently, connected with the May Day celebrations this year. So we do know they have a large number of the systems. We know they have the taps in the Earth, and they can put them in there whenever they want to, and that they can power the weapons that way. Now, when they finish the exercise, they cut off all of the taps except the original pair and one additional pair. So there's, the last I knew, there were 4 of them sitting there now, still in oscillation and resonance throughout the Earth.
Well, those taps must have to be very deep and very massive.
They go through the entire Earth. And what they're doing with those things, they're tapping off from the molten core of the Earth. Now, let's see, one other part of your question, the spark gap and so forth, I really...
I was relating to this nitrogen output to electric or high-energy frequencies in the atmosphere, creating nitrogen oxides, which in turn become, with moisture, become nitric acid.
Yes, indeed. I think that we get a lot of the nitrogen from the atmosphere anyway due to the electrical activity of storms and so forth.
Well, this was always there, and we didn't have acid rain before
I don't know what causes the acid rain. By the way, if you ever find anybody that does know what causes it, I'd sure like to know. Because I'm throwing it out for listeners.
I've presented it to one authority who says, yes, it's a very interesting idea, and I can't tell you anything about it.
Oh.
All right, so that's kind of where we stand on that.
But thank you.
Good questions, Bob. Appreciate them very much.
Thank you, Tom.
Thank you, Bob.
It's Open Mind. I'm Bill Jenkins. With me, Thomas E. Bearden.
Oh, we can get copies of Let's Talk.
Let's Talk is a magazine that you can subscribe to just by contacting the radio station. I think it's also going to be on the newsstands when the next issue is out and the last one. They're located, Valley Publishing is the publisher of it out in Granada Hills. You can call there.
Okay, I'd like to know from Tom where we can get copies of the energy releases that were taken by the satellites off of Bennett Island.
The best place is in Aviation Week. I don't have the reference right in front of me, but Aviation Week printed three photographs. I also have included the same three photographs in one of Novaya Zemlya, exhaust off of that, in the tape that we've just made, the videotape that's available.
I'd like to know why would the Soviets be testing these devices off Japan and South Africa if they wanted the weapon to be a secret weapon? It seems to me they would want to test it over their own uninhabited territory or else shoot the beams out in space and take measurements from there.
Well, of course, they may have done that too.
But why would they be, you know, putting them either off of Japan or off of South Africa where other people could see them and perhaps take some form of measurements?
Same reason that they fire missiles into areas like that. They fire missiles into designated areas of the ocean. As a matter of fact...
Tom, could I get you to speak up? And Bob, or Jim,
yeah.
Could you kind of back away? We're getting kind of a little off balance there.
Oh, okay. How's this, Bill? I'm as close as I can get.
That's better. All right.
Okay. It's conventional to test weapons in various ocean areas of the world. For example, in that cold explosion off Japan, just a few days before that, the Soviets had very hastily announced missile tests to be conducted in an area not very far from there. So they do this quite often. And they fire missiles into areas and so forth. And nations of the world warn other nations when they're going to be testing in certain areas and warn them to stay out of there. That's very conventional.
Seems to me that for a weapon system like this, though, they'd want to test it over Siberia where nobody else could have their spy ships in the vicinity to be able to keep an eye on it.
Well, all I can tell you is they're testing it throughout the Earth the same way... They don't hesitate to do that whenever they feel they need to, just like they've not hesitated to blast out of the air a whole series of airplanes, not just the Korean airliner.
Mm-hmm.
Defense Weekly, for example, not too long after the loss of that Korean airliner, printed a listing of the actual airplanes that have been shot down the same way by the Soviet Union. So it's not spectacular for them to do things that... We think is not quite the way we would do it.
You mentioned grid adjustment a while back. Do they need physical observers in the area to be able to verify this adjustment?
That I don't know. They certainly have enough of them. The FBI has given up trying to track all the known Soviet agents in the U.S. because there are more Soviet agents admitted by the FBI, mm-hmm. known ones in the United States, than there are FBI agents.
Do you happen to know of any U.S. spy satellite photos of these transmitters?
No, I know of none because I wouldn't have access to that information. Everything that I'm doing has come totally from open information.
Considering the power requirements of these transmitters, do you feel that they'd be able to place these on ships?
Yes, there's no problem with that. Of course, on this program, quite often, you've had some free energy discussions. Several devices now are working to produce energy out of the vacuum. I might point out that if you look at two electrons, the electromagnetic force between those two electrons is somewhere on the order of about 10 to the 38th times as strong as the gravitational force. Now, what does this mean? This means that if you could convert 100% of that electromagnetic force into the gravitational force, for every unit of electromagnetic force you had to begin with, you would get 10 to the 38th units of gravitational force. So if you can convert just a fraction of the electromagnetic energy into gravitational energy with the scalar electromagnetics, you can get local bending of space-time that is very appreciable, and therefore you can build free energy devices. It's absolutely within the present physics theory.
Would you happen to know of any sort of U.S. intelligence that would tell us of unusual ships that might have this sort of equipment on them?
Well, you understand, if I didn't know about it, I wouldn't talk about it.
Well, I thought that perhaps, you know, Jane's military, the book that usually comes out, they usually have new weapon systems and such, or perhaps even speculate on some. I thought that maybe there was something out there in for the general public to consume that I didn't know about.
There are very authoritative books put out by Jane's and others on Soviet weapons. Now, one of the problems you have here, and that's a good question, by the way, one of the problems you have is the transmitter itself has now become the key weapon. But you see, in our lexicon in the West, we do not address that kind of a weapon at all. And so we never identify any kind of weapon officially as being that. It's only recently that in various places throughout the military here in the U.S., people are finally beginning to get somewhat seriously interested in what we're talking about here. They're now beginning to take it seriously, and they're not scoffing at it anymore. I'm not saying they believe everything I'm saying. I'm just saying they're now taking it seriously.
Okay, Jim, does that help you? We got a lot of calls here. Yeah, very good group of questions, and we appreciate those.
Well, I'd like to ask one more, if that's okay.
I'd make it quick.
Okay, since these devices can extract energy as well as place it into an area, have any of our power companies been noticing unusual drain-offs? Because it seems to me that if the Soviets could extract it, that they would use it instead of having to build their own hydroelectric facilities or something like that.
Well, it's a lot easier to do it with other ways than have to extract it from a distance and then try to use it, because when you extract it, it's coming back as something you've got to get rid of, or it's right in your transmitter and it's going to bother you. So as far as I know, they're not using that kind of means for any kind of power source. They may be involved, and I say maybe because I've not had time to try to do any analysis on it. They may be involved in a few of the anomalous power outages we've had in the United States and Canada as well.
Thank you very much. It's been awfully nice speaking with you.
Thank you, Jim.
Bye. Jim, good questions. I'm Bill Jenkins. With me, Tom Bearden. Weather, war, and we're talking to Craig way up in Northern California. Welcome aboard.
Hi, Bill.
Mm-hmm.
Hi, Tom.
Hi, Craig.
We've had a number of excellent conversations in the past. I've always been fascinated by what you have to say. I find a good deal of what you had to say tonight to be plausible. I'm going to subject you to some more serious questions tonight. Let me put it this way. When you're talking about a subject as sensitive as U.S.-Soviet relations, military and otherwise, something that can't be discussed too carefully, I think you understand what I mean by that.
I've spent quite a few years in that kind of business.
Right. Let's see. First of all, the last two questioners have kind of started off some of the lines of questions I had in mind. First of all, could you give me a rough ballpark figure of the amount of energy that would be required to divert the jet stream?
Offhand, I couldn't without, you know, taking time out to actually do some calculations. I have not done those. You'd have to produce, you know, some large high-pressure areas, and you'd have to produce some large lows. And it wouldn't be just energy. You'd have to have power, because you'd have to keep extracting energy from the low to keep it low, and you'd have to keep adding energy to the high to keep it high.
Uh-huh.
So it's a matter of so much power, you see.
Well, are you saying that you have done the calculations
in
the past?
No, I have not.
Well, I would think that's a very basic requirement if we're going to assert that anybody on the planet has the capability to do that.
Tell you what, why don't you make the calculation and send them to me?
Well, I'm asking you, because
I'm going to put the onus right back on you. It's your idea. You make the calculation.
Okay, I'll leave that one for the moment. Let's see. Okay, you were discussing a related subject. One of the callers was talking about the possibility of using the Earth's resonances to create a very serious disturbance of the entire planet. And has anybody gone through the energy calculations and power calculations for such a thing?
Well, it depends on whether you're talking about a diode or a triode. For example, if you're talking about the use of something in a diode fashion, you've got to put all the energy in, you're going to get used in the system. But if you're talking about using it in the triode fashion, where you just put the signal in which gates some other flow of energy, then you're not talking about the same kind of energy requirements. And there are ways to do it in the Earth, apparently, where you can use a sort of a triode effect. In other words, you can gate a series of systems that already go on in the Earth. If you do that, it doesn't take you putting in all the energy to get the energy acting in the Earth. In other words, you can draw energy from the molten core of the Earth, and it can furnish the energy you're using. You've
right.
just got to gate it.
Right, I understand. Would there be anything analogous to that, then, in terms of diverting something like the jet stream?
No, as far as I know, and I understand there may be other mechanisms that I do not know about.
Mm-hmm.
But as far as I know, the mechanism they seem to be using is the production of high pressure areas by adding energy throughout a zone, and the production of low pressure areas by withdrawing energy from that zone. Now, I will say this, working with a scientist there in California, and I will not name the scientist, he has done the little cold explosion type of thing, for example, with scalar beams over a little dish of water in the lab. Now, we're just using milliwatts of power, you understand. We don't have enormous transmitters cranked up.
Right.
He was using milliwatts of power and created a little cold explosion over a dish of water. When that happens, you have...